Support for KPLU and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, with a reminder that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Thomas Blank was condemned to hang. This was before Governor Jay Inslee's moratorium on the death penalty. More than a century before, actually. This story takes place in 1895. Well, I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and to start this week's Sound Effect, I wanted to give you just a little taste of this tale. It's of the man known as the Jesse James of the Pacific Northwest. So the previous year, Blank had ambled into a saloon in Seattle called Billy the Mugs. At least I assume he ambled, that's what you do in 1894, and he was looking to rob the bar, but instead, the bartender pulled a revolver on him, and Blank shot the guy dead. This was nothing new for Blank. He'd later admit to killing at least five people, including a King County Sheriff's deputy and a Puyallup City Marshal. Several of his victims were lawmen, because every time he was cornered, Blank blasted his way out and just went right on misbehaving. Even after he was finally arrested, he tried to escape during his trial. Only a gun butt to the face would subdue him. And at last, he was convicted of murder and sentenced to death. He was off to King County Jail. And there he sat for 5 months, awaiting the hangman's noose. Until, that is, he carved a fake gun out of wood, held up his jailer, and broke out along with 10 more prisoners. Blank finally did die in a hail of bullets in Aurelia, Washington, but not before becoming a kind of folk hero of the 19th century Northwest, part of the outlaw persona that's baked into our region's identity. For today's Sound Effect on KPLU, our theme is Trouble with the Law, from a bank robber turned star lawyer to a notorious serial killer. These are some of our most memorable stories of crime and justice. Don't go away. The Northwest has always had a complicated relationship with the law. People who refuse to jaywalk, and yet we get bricks through our window every May 1st. And one place where all this ambivalence plays out is smack in the middle of downtown Seattle, at Westlake Park. It's a haven for free speech, and also for what often goes by the term disorder. And by that I mean people openly using drugs or peeing in the alley, and sometimes actual harassment, or worse. We are going to talk to a Seattle police officer about how you go about enforcing the rules in a place like that. But first, we're going to meet someone else. He's one of the young people who hang out around the park, smoking, panhandling, glowering. But he's a lot more than that. He's also a bit of a sociologist. And a heads up, there are a handful of beeped words coming up. He would give his name only as Shake.
Like Shake, Rattle, and Roll.
What kind of folks come down here? How would you describe it to people who have never been here before?
Scumbags, juggalos, and raver kids.
What's the scene like?
I don't know the scene. I'm not part of the scene anymore. I'm too old. Those kids over there, they're part of the scene.
Yeah, you feel like you're in a different generation from that crew on the camp?
Yeah, I'm a generation removed. All those kids, I grew up watching these kids. They learned everything from me.
How much older do you think that you are from them then?
I don't know, 3 or 4 years, which is like 20 years in gutter punk time. So they're doing the same old shit, but worse.
Like what?
They're just worse, man. Like all these kids, they grew up out here like dropping a E-bomb and having fun and being all happy, and they made fun of all us strung out, burnt out, like, you know, we were like too late for the whole grunge, like nihilist generation, but we still like carried over some of that pessimism. All these kids were all like happy and like, you know, jumping around wearing candy bracelets, but now they're all part of the same scene, man. They're sitting there with like their mouths hanging open and flies like, you know, flying in and out of their mouths, and same old thing.
Are you pals with those guys or not necessarily?
No, yeah, I'm pals with them. Yeah, they're all right. I wouldn't call them, like, friends. Yeah. You know, like, you know, I'm tentative with all those kids.
Yeah. So Westlake Park in general, like, would you say, like, how safe or unsafe would you say this place is?
Oh, it's safe. You know, as long as you're, like, don't get involved with it, you're all right. If you don't know these people, you should probably stay away from them. I don't know, this place isn't dangerous. Nobody's going to, like, attack you randomly. Like, the people that get attacked and beat up around here, it's because they were, like, you know, in the in the first place, they were involved in it.
Would you say you see more cops now than before, or any different?
Hell yeah, way more cops, way more police now.
What do you think the cops that are here should be doing?
I don't know pretty much what they're doing. They're good. They're good. Actually, the cops ain't bad. See, the cops back in the day, there was only a few of them, but they just beat you up and, like, take your shit. Like, the cops nowadays, they actually kind of try to help. They're not bad. There's just a lot of them.
So I met up with one of those officers. Captain Chris Fowler is in charge of SPD's West Precinct, which covers downtown, including Westlake Park, and we took a walk.
Give me a sense of kind of how you see a space like this. Like, let us look through your eyes a little bit. What are you looking for and what are you paying attention to?
So we're really committed to making sure the park is available for everybody that wants to use it. I think we find out over many years in policing that we always can't arrest our way out of a situation. Clearly, if there's violence, clearly if there's domestic violence, clearly if there's such a behavioral crisis that that person needs help, we're always there available to either make an arrest if necessary or to detain the individuals and get them into the services that they're needed. But what we see on a daily basis are really just people who live here, and it was never intended for that purpose, so we have to figure out a different way.
Yeah, because it's hard to do that without breaking some laws, right? I mean, where do you go to the bathroom? Where do you smoke your pot? Where do you go when you're drunk?
Yeah, absolutely. And it isn't just a matter of law enforcement. I mean, the laws are designed so that if somebody does something that's against the law or a violation and you write them a ticket, then they feel compelled to not do it again, to pay their ticket. But you're talking about people that are in economic crisis, that have serious mental health issues, and that type of enforcement does not always work. When I got to the West Precinct, we put together a bit of a continuum of response. So on one end of the continuum, it's pure outreach to those individuals that truly want a place to live, they want services. And on the other end, it's an arrest to push through the criminal justice system.
Those have got to be hard calls to make on the spot, I imagine. So what's an officer have to evaluate? When you come up to somebody, how do I know?
You work down here every day and you say the same people over and over, you begin to know. I warned him 3 days ago, 2 days ago, this individual's really in crisis.
How do you take care that you're not enforcing the law selectively based on, say, unconscious biases?
Well, it comes down to the objective fact. Did the individual break a specific violation or a law? And if they did, what have we done to address that? So it's all about the individual's actions, not necessarily the demographic or the group that they hang out in. It gets a little muddy when you've got different groups that are out here doing different levels of crime. And although we're in Westlake Park and this is much more of a social service outreach park violation kind of issue, we can walk up a block to 3 and Pine and see where more criminal activity comes into play.
Well, shall we do that?
Sure.
All right.
We headed down Pine and hung a left on 3rd Avenue, and within a minute, we came upon police activity.
Yeah, so we're in a bus stop that's mid-block between Pike and Pine. One of our law enforcement partners is the Metro Transit Security. They're making an arrest.
What's going on?
He's smoking in a posted no-smoking area all along the wall here. He's got a warrant, so he's going to jail for the warrant.
He's not going to jail for smoking?
No, definitely not. It's a citation. He'll more than likely be out tomorrow.
There was a report that was presented last year to the Community Police Commission that showed apparently that enforcement of these kind of low-level crimes that we're talking about was down substantially, something like 50% between 2005 and 2013. How do you read a stat like that?
Clearly, the enforcement is down because we're looking at other options in dealing with the same problem.
So you see that as a basically good news, that there's a wider range of options available to you to help people and address the issues than just arrests.
Yes, because at the end of the day, the officer's job is to either assist the individuals or enforce the laws. I mean, we're an enforcement agency. But we certainly want to help people that need that help. But at the end of the day, if the hospitals don't have the capacity to deal with the behavioral health issues, then they're right back out on the street again. And at some point, they end up getting into the enforcement side of it.
A lot of the conversation about, you know, what's the right level of enforcement for low-level crime comes back to the broken windows theory, the idea that disorder, low-level offenses, visible quality of life crimes can lead to a sense that there is not social controls in an area and that then people can, you know, be free to do more serious crime. I don't know, where are you with that philosophy? You must have thought about it. Is there a connection? What is the connection between these quality of life crimes and more major crime?
Well, I think that's an oversimplification, that if you allow quality of life issues to exacerbate, then the whole area falls apart. I don't believe that's the case. We saw over the last couple of years where, in fact, those very quality of life issues have gotten worse downtown. But really what's happened is the community stepped up, reestablished their expectations. We sort of re-energized our efforts along with many other agencies within the city. So I think instead of seeing an enhance and decay, what you see is a community stepping up to address some of these issues across a broad spectrum. And so before seeing that, I might have said, yeah, if you let people sleep on the sidewalks, if you let them drink, if you let them smoke, then the whole place goes downhill. But in fact, I think everybody begins to step up to address some of these issues. And they're long-term and they're complicated.
So you think your personal view on that has evolved a little bit?
It really has, yeah. I think it's forced everybody to take action versus just sit back and point the finger at each other. And that includes the police department.
Captain Chris Fowler is in charge of the Seattle Police Department's West Precinct, which includes Westlake Park and most of downtown. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week we are talking about trouble with the law. This next story deals with one Seattle woman's trouble with a particular law. It was a law that prevented Jenny Grant from having a glass of fresh goat's milk. Well, you see, it was illegal to keep a goat in Seattle, which to Grant just seemed ridiculous. So at first she was hoping to just bend the rules to protect her illegal urban farm, but instead she ended up taking the law into her own hands and changing it for everybody. KPLU's Jennifer Wing shares Grant's story.
Jenny Grant craved fresh goat's milk. She got a taste of it in California and was surprised it wasn't musty. Grant knew goats in Seattle weren't legal, but she got one anyway, a white mini La Mancha. She named her Snowflake.
Well, the rules said that you couldn't keep farm animals such as sheep or cows. And so I thought, well, what is a farm animal? I mean, dogs and cats were originally farm animals. I mean, if you love your goat and you take them on a walk periodically and you fuss over them, aren't they a pet also?
Grant was able to keep Snowflake under the radar for a while in her backyard in Madrona until a young girl about a mile away got really sick.
With what they thought was Q fever. And she was hospitalized. She could have died.
Q fever is a bacterial infection spread by goats and cows. It can make someone seriously ill if they have a weak immune system. The girl's family started asking neighbors if someone nearby had goats.
They said, yes, there is a woman with goats in the neighborhood.
So the health department came.
They saw that the goats hadn't spread the disease, that my goats had never had this disease. And then later they found out that she didn't even have Q fever.
Snowflake was innocent. But now the city was on to what was going on in Grant's backyard.
Once I was turned in, I got a note on my porch that said, we understand that you have goats on the premises and you got to get rid of them.
Grant was not going to let that happen. Not only did she have Snowflake, she had Snowflake's newborn kids to think about. She asked the city, can't you just let this slide by?
I was looking for an exception to the rule. But they said, no, we got to just change the rule, which kind of makes sense.
So why was owning a goat in Seattle against the law? Well, city leaders started putting restrictions on farm animals 90 years ago, back when Seattle was growing and changing more than it is today. Around the turn of the last century, urban and bucolic existed side by side. On the way to a performance at the Grand Opera House on Cherry Street, it would not have been unusual to see a child grazing cows on empty lots. Back then, Seattle had hundreds of cows, horses, and a handful of goats.
So the city had city herders who worked under the police department.
That's Fred Brown. He's writing a book due out next year called The City is More Than Human, an Animal History of Seattle.
And there was a cattle pound, which was the equivalent of the dog pound. And the cattle pound was where cattle and horses that were roaming unattended would be taken there.
Brown says Seattle's quest to become a more sophisticated and upper-middle-class town led to laws banning all farm animals, unless you owned a sizable piece of property in town. By 1957, even chickens weren't spared. From Grant's perspective, not only did these laws openly express dislike for the poor who lived off the land, they were also land grabs from real estate developers looking to make a fortune.
So they came up with ideas that it was unsafe for children and women and so forth, and they passed laws to get rid of the farm animals. Because once you couldn't keep a farm animal in the city, you had to move out of the city, and then what did you have to do with your land? You had to sell it to a real estate developer.
Over the years, a bit of the country has crept back into the city. Chickens, ducks, and turkeys made it back first in 1982. It wasn't until 2007 that goats got their day. Grant got together with other goat enthusiasts and created the Goat Justice League. Their mission? To convince the Seattle City Council that people had a right to own goats. The council said yes, unanimously, but with a few conditions. Only 2 goats per household. They have to be 100 pounds or less. No horns are allowed, and the males have to be castrated. Since her victory, Grant is now known as the Goat Lady.
When people say, oh, you're the Goat Lady, I always have to say, well, some people call me Jenny Grant.
She went on to write a book called City Goats, the Goat Justice League's Guide to Backyard Goat Keeping. And Snowflake had her moment of fame, too. The Stranger put her on the cover when Seattle voters approved gay marriage.
Something about, like, the anti-gay marriage people were arguing that if they let gay men marry men, that men would soon want to marry goats. So it was sort of a play on that. Apparently nobody got it, but Snowflake got to be on the cover.
And one of Snowflake's grandsons
works for Rent-A-Ruminant, and they were on the Stephen Colbert Report, that herd, the Rent-A-Ruminant herd for goats stealing Americans' jobs.
Goats, if you're going to steal our landscaping jobs, humans are going to start producing feta cheese.
Even though the door to goat ownership has been open for several years, not too many people are taking advantage of it. In the 83.9 square miles of Seattle, there are only 46 licensed goats and 3 potbelly pigs. Back in Madrona in Grant's backyard, it's late in the day and it's milking time. Snowflake now has another goat, Eloise, to keep her company. All goats are herd animals and require companions. They live at the bottom of the terraced backyard. Lake Washington is just below us. Henry and Lucy, my 2 kids, are here to try out their milking skills.
Oh, may I try?
Yep. You want to go on that side of her, Lucy?
I remember how to do it.
Okay, you take that. So you pinch off the top and then squeeze the bottom. Henry, don't sweat your sister. All right, Henry. Henry, open your mouth. Get closer.
Henry's not so sure about having goat's milk squirted directly into his mouth.
You don't want it in your mouth?
No,
it's the freshest milk there is.
We get about a quart of milk from Grant's other goat, Eloise. In the summer, she produces a gallon a day. Some of it ends up as delicious cheese. It's getting dark, so we round up Grant's chickens and put the goats into their shed. There's a deck at the top that the goats like to hop up on. It has a gorgeous view of the lake. Grant says if you decide to keep goats, you should give them the best view possible, so you can enjoy it too. She warns that you'll be spending more time there than any other part of your garden, milking, feeding, watering, and sweeping. For Grant, the bond with the animals and the access to fresh food is all worth the work. And while she's very proud of what she's done to make goats legal, she says the law does have some flaws. Yes, you can own a goat or two, but walking them around the neighborhood on a leash, that's still illegal.
That story from KPLU's Jennifer Wing. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's show is all about trouble with the law. And some of the content on today's show is not going to be appropriate for kids or some other listeners, and that includes this next story, which is about the Green River Killer. So Gary Ridgway was convicted of 49 murders, which is more than any other American serial killer, In fact, he's suspected of having killed many more throughout the 80s and 90s. Ridgway dumped some of his bodies in the Green River and hid others in forests and parks throughout King County, and he would return there later to perform acts of necrophilia. And believe me, I would not mention that if it weren't relevant to the story. So Tom Jensen was the main detective on the Green River case, and he spent more than 20 years hunting for the killer. After Ridgway was arrested in 2001, Jensen actually came out of retirement to spend 188 days drawing out details about the murders from Ridgway himself. Senior producer Arwin Nix met with Detective Jensen's son, Jeff Jensen. He wrote a graphic novel-style book about his father's decades-long connection to the serial killer, and he describes how that took a toll on his father.
I was 12 years old. It was the summer of 1982. I was actually visiting my grandmother in eastern Washington in a small town called Winthrop, Washington. And so here I was, several hundred miles away from Seattle, and reading about this horror show that is taking place in Seattle, where the bodies of the first 3 to 4 victims were found in the Green River.
That's Jeff Jensen. He's an entertainment writer, and also the author of the book, Green River Killer, A True Detective Story.
Everyone always told me, you're going to write a book about your dad one day.
Everyone always told him that because his dad was the main detective on the Green River Killer case. And I had the chance to talk with Jeff recently when he came to visit his now retired police detective dad. We discussed the case and the murders, but we focused on the end of his father's time on the case, and that's what his book focuses on. Because, as part of a plea deal, Gary Ridgway was moved into an office park at Boeing Field in the summer of 2003, and he lived there, on a mattress in an empty room, with 24-hour armed guards at the door, and cubicles outside of it where the detectives would sit.
To go 20 years searching for this guy, to now just like coming to work every day and walking past Gary Ridgway in the morning like, Gary, Tom.
It took 3 times longer than they thought it would to get the evidence they needed from Ridgway. Jeff's father, Detective Jensen, was there for all 188 long days of it. And when I spoke with Jeff, I asked him about his father's experience questioning Ridgway and what that process was like.
What they encountered right away with him was this fuzzy memory, the imprecise recollection of each victim, sometimes certain memories of killing one person blurring into another, and an odd reticence to him, like, They couldn't quite figure him out. And over that first weekend of interviewing him, this thing emerged where it's like, why is he like this? Surely he should be able to remember. Is he holding things back? Is that possible? I mean, he's here to tell us everything. Why is he holding back on some things? And there were some things that in particular the detectives knew that they believed that the Green River Killer should know, one of them being necrophilia. They knew that he had had sex with the victims after he'd killed them. But he wouldn't go there. I mean, he wouldn't talk about that. And he denied doing that for 72 hours of the whole investigation.
There is a breakthrough of the many breakthroughs that I want to ask you about. And it's when your father was questioning Gary Ridgway and he himself broke down
right
in the questioning. When was that in this timeline and what happened?
So on the morning of the fifth day, my father and another detective, John Mattson, led Gary into sort of like a conversation about any number of things. But the thing that they zeroed in on right away is necrophilia. So my father and John Mattson kind of conducted this interview in which they made Gary feel safe and even empathized with him. And he went from admitting, yes, I did have sex with one body, to confessing that he had sex with several bodies. And now my father is feeling something else, which is guilt. Like, I'm doing it, I'm getting the success, but it's horrible what I'm hearing. I'm feeling proud about this. Like, what? The latter half of this morning conversation with Gary focused on one victim in particular, a victim that Gary claimed that he had some emotional attachment to. The victim, Carol Christensen. There was oddities attached to her case that always nagged at my father and made her stick out. And so he had some kind of connection with her. I don't want to overstate it, But she represented something to him, I think. And so they got Gary to talk about killing this woman. And up until that point, Gary refused to really take responsibility for wanting to kill these women. He always blamed it on them. There was something about, like, he just wanted sex, and then they did something to not satisfy him, or he got scared and he snapped and he killed. And my father hated this kind of blame shifting.
He hated that Ridgway was saying these women triggered him, that it was their fault.
That's right. My father hated the fact that this man was blaming the women, really, for him killing them. And what he wanted to hear from Gary is, I did it. I didn't just want to, like, have sex with these women. I wanted to destroy these women. My dad wanted to hear him take responsibility for destroying these lives. So he kind of led Gary down this sort of just very logical road of just making him aware, look, you knew what you were doing. You have responsibility for the pattern that you see emerging in your life. But you didn't do anything about stopping it. So you, from the moment you picked up these women, you knew you wanted to kill them, didn't you? And Gary finally said yes, and he finally confessed to that. And my hearing that just devastated my dad. It was what he wanted to hear, but it was also hard to hear. And he said in that moment, Gary, you've touched me. And he said, I need to take a break. And my dad, who, if you listen to the tape of him interviewing Gary during this session, he's struggling to keep it together. And he leaves and he goes to another room and he breaks down and cries.
Finally, Ridgway is convicted.
Yeah.
And your father can be done with this case that he's spent nearly 20 years working on.
Yeah.
What was that like for your father once Ridgway was finally put away for these murders?
My dad says that there's only been a handful of times in this whole case that he has shed tears over it. One was that morning on the fifth day when he got Gary to confess to the things that he confessed to. But one of the other times was on the day in which he finally was in court and heard Gary Ridgway plead guilty to all of these things, and he cried, and I think it was relief, I think it was despair, it was just be able to finally release all of the emotions, frustrations of 20 years of keeping it all inside and being strong and tough for his family, for his community, for the case, to be at the end of it. I mean, it was just catharsis for a lot of complicated emotions that I don't think we have words for, you know.
Jeff Jensen is the author of Green River Killer, A True Detective Story. He spoke with Sound Effects senior producer Arwin Nix. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here. We're talking about trouble with the law today. Bank robbery. It's one of those things that is easy to imagine and maybe even to romanticize. And Sean Hopwood did that. But then he took the next step. He robbed five banks.
And I had kind of glamorized it because at the time I was a very immature young man. And young men that are foolish tend to glamorize the wrong things. And so that played, I wouldn't say a large role, but it played a role in being able to say yes to something that I should have very quickly said no to.
Sean didn't say no. When the idea came up as a half joke between him and his friend, they didn't drop it. Sean's life had not been going great at that time. He wasn't working, he was staying with friends, and he was into alcohol and drugs and dealing with some pretty severe depression. So over the next 6 months, Sean and his partner in crime hatched a plan. And then on August 19th, 1997, they walked into a Petersburg State Bank in Nebraska.
When I walked into those banks, everything in my body told me to leave and get out of there and not do it. And I remember having to, you know, calm my nerves. I just remember that we went in and we tried to get in and out of there as fast as we possibly could. I'm talking like 2 or 3 minutes. And I remember that the first bank robbery, a lady came in the middle of it. And, you know, she was very scared. And I remember, you know, telling her that everything was going to be all right and we were going to be out of there very soon.
Did you hand him a note? Did you demand it in a...
No. So I had walked in first and I had a toolbox with bags inside the toolbox that my partner was going to get the bags out and put the money in the bags. So I dropped the toolbox, and when I dropped it, everybody in the bank turned and looked at me, and I yelled, "This is a robbery," and that's when my friend came in.
This is a robbery. Had you rehearsed that?
No. I mean, what else are you supposed to say? It sounds pretty lame, but, you know.
Robbing banks changed Sean's life, and not just in the ways you would assume. Just to cut to much later in the story, Hopwood would eventually become a lawyer, a very successful lawyer, one who had cases before the Supreme Court even before he had applied to law school. And we're going to get to all that, but first let's hear what happened when they left that first bank.
We actually dropped the stolen car off and jumped into a grain truck that my partner's family owned. And we had a handheld scanner, and I could hear the police say, "Well, we think we've got him." And I thought we were getting pulled over and this was it, that they had us. Did not realize that they had pulled over 2 18-year-old boys on the highway and thought that they had robbed the bank, and that's who they were talking about, not us.
So for all you knew, the fuzz was right outside.
Yeah, so I thought they were right behind us, and this was it, and that was, we were both going to prison right then and there.
How did you think about the possibility of getting caught? Was it something that you imagined or envisioned?
Yes, I always knew we were going to get caught.
You knew?
Oh, yes. Especially the more that we did. I mean, I knew it was only a matter of time. My big, this will kind of fill you in on the desperation I felt at the time. My hope was that, you know, when they came to arrest me, they would just shoot me and that would be the end of it. But I was never under any illusion that we were going to get away with this.
So you want to tell the story of how you did get caught?
I was headed to a hotel room to go pick up my brother, and I walked in, and I went to the hotel room and knocked on the door, and there was no answer. And I walked back through the lobby and didn't really pay much attention to the fact that there were 5 guys sitting in suits. They got up and tackled me, and I was in handcuffs before I knew it, and that's when I realized that the FBI had just arrested me.
So what was that like as it kind of dawned on you, like, wow, this doesn't just end with me, my life ending. This ends with me having to go to court and figure out how I'm going to plead and go to prison and live life in prison. Like, how did that sort of dawn on you?
When it really hit me was when my parents came to visit me and my mom was crying and realizing the aftermath and all of the pain I had caused, not only to family members, but to friends, to the people that were in those banks, to people in my community. And, you know, it hit me like a ton of bricks. There are still days I wake up and I think about what I did and how I hurt the people that were close to me.
And did you have that thought that, you know, I'm going straight, I'm going to fix my life and make up for what I did? Did that thought pop in your head?
Not at that time, no. It's just really hard to get up and say, I need to make changes when you're facing a 10, 20, 30-year prison sentence. Because there's not much hope, and you really have to have some hope to be able to make those sorts of changes. And it wasn't until, you know, a couple of years into my sentence when I found the law and started finding a purpose in life, that things really began to change for me.
The way you just described, you know, finding the law and finding your purpose, I mean, it sounds like finding religion almost. Was it a religious type experience for you?
Well, it was the first thing I had done academically that I was good at and that I was successful at. And, you know, when you find something you're good at, more times than not, you become passionate about it. And then what I found out was not only could I be good at it, but I could actually help other people. And I really was drawn towards that, the part of helping others. And so that's kind of what sucked me in. I wouldn't say it was a religious experience. It was just an awakening.
What is it in you that emerged in that way?
I know that I don't mind a good argument. prison is a good place to prepare one for lots of confrontation. And so that doesn't scare me either, which two very good traits to have as a lawyer. And I found it intellectually challenging in a way that I had not any other subject in school previously.
So there's a long and well-worn tradition of jailhouse lawyers in this country. What was the kind of culture of that like? In the places where you were incarcerated, was there a certain caste of people who were the jailhouse lawyers, and how did people treat them?
There were, but it was a rather diverse group: older, younger, black, white, Hispanic. There were all different types of jailhouse lawyers. It gave me a certain status. Not at first so much, because you know there are lots of jailhouse lawyers in prison. There are very few jailhouse lawyers that actually have success. To do what I did, which was get the Supreme Court to grant a case, it's about a 1% chance. And so these aren't things that happen very often. And the more success I had, the greater my status became in prison.
We will hear more about Sean Hopwood and all about the big break that got him to where he is today after we take our little break. Don't go away. Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we're about to hear more of Sean Hopwood's story of trouble with the law. That's our theme today, and in case you missed part one, let me just catch you up. Hopwood robbed 5 banks in Nebraska in his early 20s. He went to federal prison to serve more than 10 years, and at this point in our story, that's where he is. But he's earned a place for himself in prison, doing something that surprised just about everybody, including himself, being a really talented jailhouse lawyer.
Well, so I had gone from looking at my own case and filing a brief on my own behalf to writing memos for the other prisoners' lawyers suggesting claims that could be raised on appeal to actually then writing briefs for prisoners. And the second or third brief I prepared was for a man named John Fellers. He was in on a conspiracy to distribute methamphetamine and had a 12-year sentence and was recently denied in the Court of Appeals. And he came to me and said, "Listen, Sean, the Court of Appeals denied my appeal. I just got off the phone with my lawyer. He said we have no chance in the Supreme Court. And so I really have nobody to do the Supreme Court petition. Would you do it?" And I knew that I didn't know very much about the Supreme Court and that it was going to be quite the undertaking to try and get this petition for certiorari, is what it's called, filed to the U.S. Supreme Court within a 2-month period. But John was persuasive, and we filed his brief, and John was transferred to another prison, and I largely forgot about John Fellers and his case till one morning I was walking out to the recreation yard to go work out, and a friend of mine came running and screaming. My first thought was, what did I say to him yesterday that he wants to come fight me at 6:30 in the morning? What I didn't realize was he had a newspaper in his hand, and it was a copy of the USA Today, and it was the first time I had seen my words cited anywhere, let alone in a major newspaper, national newspaper.
So you end up serving a little over 10 years in federal prison, doing legal work all along. And when you got out, you got your undergraduate degree, which you hadn't had at the beginning. And you wound up getting a pretty prestigious scholarship through the Gates Foundation to the University of Washington School of Law. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what life was like in law school.
It's always strange when you walk into a place with hundreds of people or even, you know, 10 or 20 people, and everyone knows your life story and you know none of theirs. I was also a lot older than most of my classmates by at least a decade. But on the whole, people at the University of Washington treated me wonderfully.
Now you just completed a clerkship on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is generally thought to be the second most prominent court in the United States below the Supreme Court. And you're about to take a faculty position at Georgetown University School of Law. And so you're mixing with a lot of fancy lawyers, I'm guessing. And what's that like to have them know, or if they don't know, what's it like to tell them?
Oh, it's can be hilarious sometimes when you're at some reception and someone asks, well, what are you doing? And I say, going to work at Georgetown at the appellate clinic. And why appellate law? And I say, well, I kind of did appellate law for 10 years before law school, which always prompts the question, well, how did you do appellate practice before law school? Because there is a thing called the illegal practice of law out in the real world. You know, I get various degrees of reception when I tell them the story. Everything from wow to gaping mouths wide open to congratulations.
And has this made you think any differently about what the law is for? Is the law a set of, you know, moral instructions that we are obligated as members of society to follow? Is it something that's just supposed to protect us? Is it just a framework that we kind of build around us to protect us from other people? You know, what's the law supposed to do?
I think where my background has impacted me the most is maybe not, I don't hold the same reverence for the legal profession that other law school students might, in that I've seen a lot of really bad lawyers. And while I know the legal profession can be quite noble, and it oftentimes is, there's just as many times where lawyers and the law have committed grave injustices that we need to fix.
Sean, how much connection do you feel like you have still to the guy you were when you robbed those banks in your early 20s?
Not only do I no longer even consider myself the same person that robbed those banks, but it also feels like it was someone else that did those 10 years in prison. I mean, life is so different for me now. But, you know, I can tell you that I'm not the only one that goes through life and makes huge life-altering changes from 20 to what I am now is 40. If everyone goes through those changes, then why do we believe that prisoners can't change for the better and that they aren't redeemable too? Because I think most of them are.
What I'm wondering about, I guess, is that, because I'm almost the same age as you, and I feel like a very different person than I was when I was 20, 22 also. But once in a while, there's a little moment where I get a feeling or a memory or something that puts me right back in those shoes. And I'm wondering if that happens to you.
There are times where I go back to prison pretty quickly. there was one morning I was walking through the courthouse of the D.C. Circuit, and a marshal was walking by, and they must have been bringing people in that were going to be sentenced that day, because he had a handful of shackles, chains worn on your legs when you're a prisoner, to be transferred in between buildings. And I heard the rattling of those chains, and before I even saw him, it just ran a shiver up my spine, because I remember vividly having handcuffs and shackles and a belly chain. And here I am walking through this courthouse in a suit, and just that one little noise takes me back instantly.
Well, Sean Hopwood has come a long way. He is about to start teaching in the Appellate Law Clinic at Georgetown University School of Law, and he clerked for the D.C. Circuit Court. He's a UW School of Law grad, but all that came after more than 10 years in federal prison for bank robbery. And he joined us from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much, Sean, for talking to us on Sound Effect.
Thank you very much for having me. Go Huskies.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and you're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. Our show today is about trouble with the law. And in this next story, we're going to be talking about sexual assault. This piece will be about 10 minutes long, and we wanted to give our listeners some warning. Rape is incredibly common. According to a U.S. Justice Department study in the late 90s, about 1 in 6 women have experienced rape or attempted rape in their lifetimes. That makes it really, really likely that you know someone who's been raped. Probably multiple people. And yet, we rarely talk about it. Well, we're going to meet someone now who wants us to be talking about it much more. Her name is Yara Zaslow, and she was raped while serving in the Peace Corps in Burkina Faso in 2013. She's had to fly back twice as part of her trial, and she'll probably have to fly back another half dozen times in the next 10 years. She's now writing and fundraising to raise awareness about sexual violence. She sat down with Sound Effect senior producer Arwin Nix and explained how she first came out about having been raped. She did it with a status update on Facebook to all of her 1,037 friends.
Well, I feel like this is a bit of a coming out right now. Several of you know that I've been in this super shitty rape trial back in Burkina Faso, and now I found out today that the news I'd be returning soon as of September 2014 is now sometime in 2016. Because who doesn't want a 30-hour flight that ends in a traumatizing series of accusations from a bunch of homophobic police officers and judges and the accused to ever end? This is year 3 of what will be a 10 to 15-year process. This will be over and I will have children in middle school. I will be in my 40s. I will be middle-aged. I will never be able to move on because I will always be waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting.
Why did you post that?
I couldn't be alone about it anymore. You know, it is so hard to be sad, but it's also hard to be sad when no one really knows why. And I could no longer live as though I was fine.
So as you're sitting there, getting ready to draft this, what's going through your head? I mean, you have 1,000 Facebook friends. This wasn't going out to just 100 people.
Right.
This was going out to friends and friends of friends.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny, I wrote maybe 15 different things into that little cell on Facebook, and I kept deleting each one because they were all so cryptic. I had said things like, Mondays are the worst, or like, you know, I really need a pizza and a back rub, like something like that. And then finally, I was like, you know what? What am I so ashamed of? Why is what happened to me something that I have to hide? Why? What? This fear of making other people uncomfortable because of my own discomfort, because of my very real pain, it seemed like I was just giving myself like a terrible heartburn and an ulcer or something. So I finally was like, you know what? I don't want to be ashamed anymore. And I came out.
What changed?
I realized that little by little I would talk about it with people and they would say, oh, you know, that happened to me. And of course, it's a very different, each experience with sexual assault and violence is different. But we're all holding these really tragic stories inside ourselves. And it wasn't until I started talking about it with one person and then another, so much of it comes out and you end up realizing, or at least I ended up realizing that by not talking about it, it was almost like I wasn't trusting that other people had their own stories to tell about it too.
So with this shift in perspective in yourself and the way you've decided to approach coming out as someone who has survived a sexual assault, have you found that with that switch and the way you talk about it, that the reaction from people is different?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had really thought that I was burdening people. And sometimes I still feel that way. I feel apologetic about it. I think as women, we tend to be socialized to want to apologize for things. You know, I found that I'm not having to protect people as much as I thought I would have to. I'm so afraid of making other people uncomfortable or making people feel sorry for me. I don't want pity. I don't want anything but compassion, I guess, and understanding, and people maybe giving me an inch if I'm just being weird or something.
I think that you'd be reluctant to call yourself a spokesperson. But someone who is out there in the public eye talking about surviving sexual assault, do you find that more and more people are coming to you with their stories?
Absolutely.
And how does that make you feel hearing other people's stories?
Pretty f***ing pissed off, honestly. I mean, it's awful. It's awful to know how frequent it is, how common it is. That is the hardest part. I mean, when I left my post, by the time the rest of my friends had left, six of us had been sexually assaulted. And many of them didn't report. Some of them only told me. There is this rage. There's this like very visceral rage inside me at this point. And I think the best thing that we can do is just, it's like Dan Savage always says, you know, if you're gay, you got to tell everybody that you're gay, because the only time that queer people are going to have rights is if everybody knows a queer person. I feel like the only way we're going to get recognition and protection for survivors of assault is if everybody knows someone who's been assaulted. And you know what? You do. Every single person you know knows someone. It's just that the numbers are too high and it's too common for you to not know someone.
So you've come out as a survivor of this, but you also came out as gay, and you said that coming out as a survivor of rape was obviously very different, but much more difficult.
Absolutely. I thought coming out as being a gay person would be the most difficult thing I'd ever have to do. And granted, I had to do it a lot, and I have to do it every day, but it's always a kind of a party. I'm always kind of excited about being gay. Like, I love being gay. Like, I want to tell everybody I'm gay. But and I'm not like one of those like quiet gays either. I'm like one of those like, you know, I'm gay, you know. But coming out about sexual assault is different because there's no pride in it. You know, I'm not proud of what happened. It's not I'm talking about my partner, and that's because I'm gay. Let's move on with our conversation. It's, I'm a survivor of sexual assault. How do you need to process this with me? Or like, how can I process this with you? It's complicated. It's a complicated conversation, and there's no pride in it.
There's also the idea that there are perhaps some survivors of sexual assault who don't want to think about it anymore.
Of course. And I do not begrudge anybody that. People definitely don't want to think about it, and that makes sense, and I get that. People have different ways of dealing with things. Honestly, who am I to say what anyone's method of dealing with it is? You know, I would never want someone to put themselves in a situation where they feel unsafe, where they feel vulnerable and exposed if that is not okay for them. You know, I mean, this is it's a question of consent. You know, at what point is it okay for you? Is it comfortable for you to come out, and at what point is it not? I'm never going to tell my grandparents, you know, and I couldn't tell my dad. I had to ask my mom to tell my dad. And the reason I had to tell so many people was because of this trial. But if that trial wasn't happening, would I tell people? I don't know. Probably not.
What do you wish you could have said to people before you told them that you had been raped?
Oh, that's a really good question. I would tell the listener that it's scary to talk about it, not just because you have to relive it, not just because you have to think about it, not just because you have to acknowledge that it happened, but because I think a lot of people, like me, feel like they're burdening the listener. If you're listening to someone tell you that, know that they already trust you.
What happens next? Are you done coming out about this?
I don't think I'll ever be done. That's, you know, that's what gets me every time. Like, because this trial is so long, I can't really move on. You know, I can't ever stop thinking about it because I have to keep remembering stuff that happened. I have to keep, because if I forget it, I can't, it's not valid in court. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't know what's next. Maybe, I guess it would be nice if I could feel like I could stop living on my toes, you know? If I could stop having such a rapid heart rate and maybe sleep a solid 8 hours. But I don't know if that's going to happen for a while.
Yara Zaslow is a teacher, queer activist, and a writer. You can read her essay about coming out as a rape survivor at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. She spoke with Sound Effect senior producer Arwin Nix. And one quick update to this story. A few months after we spoke to Yara, she and her partner were married, and we wanted to say mazel tov. Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwin Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad. We had help this week from KPLU's Jennifer Wing. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. We're back here next week, same time, same place. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.